The New Yorker admits that they were unable to confirm with other eyewitnesses that Kavanaugh was even present at this party. Why did you print this story?
We've got a woman who was a classmate of his at Yale who went on the record to describe her own experience here. And when we started to do more reporting on it, we found another classmate who remembers hearing about it that night or the next day. We compared the accounts of these two people who've never spoken to each other, Deborah Ramirez and the person who heard about it that night. They were identical.
That was CBS This Morning's Nora O'Donnell interviewing Jane Mayer of The New Yorker about the bombshell-ish story Mayer co-wrote with Me Too investigative journalist Ronan Farrow about a second named woman who has now come out and accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of having committed sexual assault back in the 1980s. A crazy Monday to you all. I am Matt Welch, and this is The Reason Podcast Editors Roundtable Edition. 1 week ago, sitting here, was it just 1 week? Was it one life ago? We were talking about same issue, Brett Kavanaugh, and we didn't necessarily agree about much, except for one thing, that this story was going to get a whole lot worse. And my God, has it. Jesus. Joining me as usual, though unusually in the same tiny broom closet in Washington, D.C., is Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, Catherine Mangu Ward. Are you guys going to survive the hour in there?
We are actually in the Reason Library, surrounded by creepy artifacts, including a headless dummy. So it's weird, but not proximity-based
it's
weird.
It's pretty capacious, really. It's a big open space, Matt, with a lot of books.
Kind of describes the libertarian movement.
Yeah. A big open space with a lot of books.
Yeah. And weird, creepy stuff. Not creepy.
There's going to be a callback later on to that comment if I have anything to do with it, which probably means that it won't. But
aren't you the moderator?
So I should point out.
I'm thinking he should have his own podcast called The Callback with Matt Welch.
I'm a jazz man, Peter Suderman. Okay?
The jazz man.
I don't know where this is going.
With Matt Welch.
Happy birthday, John Coltrane.
Yeah. We're going to let this one go out.
This all turned out
smooth
well,
and clean.
Literally
this
half an hour ago before
the jazz man, and I am your host.
He's actually got a voice for that. We should go somewhere with that. So a half hour ago before we're going to hit the record button here, obviously, Axios.
You know what I like about Axios? Not only does it get the news out real quickly, they come in so many different flavors. You know, the deodorant.
I've lost you, Nick.
Yeah.
Right.
You and me both. You
at
and the country.
Rate, Rod Rosenstein is trundling to the White House right now, and according to everybody, he's either going to be fired or he's going to resign, and that's going to swallow the entire news up whole, and it'll happen while we are talking. So,
but will he be recording it? Will Rod Rosenstein be recording it?
No, Omarosa will be recording it remotely, as she has been doing.
Wait,
all along,
are you so you're saying she privatized the NSA?
We're in favor.
I'm saying that this is a simulation. It's fine. Let's go back to Brett Kavanaugh, Peter Suderman, and we'll monitor Rosenstein as we're going along. But there's so much bizarre foliage that has sprung up around this this whole thing. So let's start with kind of where the podcast started, which is the New Yorker story, which seemed a little bit odd and curious. Peter, can you walk us through the kind of vast difference between how the New Yorker presented its findings and how the New York Times, which investigated the same alleged incident, did, and what we might make of that?
So on Sunday afternoon, this actually starts with the Drudge Report, the media aspect of it anyway, reported that Ronan Farrow may have an accusation of a second woman of alleged sexual misconduct against Judge Kavanaugh. And then that story came out in The New Yorker. It was co-bylined by Ronan Farrow and by Jane Mayer. And that story basically was that there was a woman who went to Yale with Kavanaugh, and that while he was, I believe, a freshman at Yale, during a party in a dorm in which there was a lot of drinking, and the woman admits that she was part of this drinking and that there were gaps in her memory as a result, he as part of this, as part of a drinking game, exposed himself to her. It seems like perhaps caused her to touch it without consent. That's the New Yorker's, that's the allegation in the New Yorker's story. And then if you read further into the story, there is one confirming source, and that confirming source was not an eyewitness. This was a person who said that they heard about the incident from someone else. So the New Yorker, if you read far enough into the story, confirms that they did not speak with or confirm with any other eyewitnesses that Judge Kavanaugh was even at this alleged event that happened more than three decades ago while he was at, that supposedly happened while he was at Yale. And so the Times then, of course, ran their latest story on the Kavanaugh confirmation process and didn't lead with this, but instead, several paragraphs into the story, noted that they too had been investigating this. They heard the story, in part, I would guess, because Senate Democrats appear to have this story. And so that's one of the sort of notable subbits about the structure of the New Yorker story, is that it basically frames the news not so much as this happened, but as Senate Democrats have heard that this might have happened and are looking into it. And so that's in some ways how the New Yorker gets away with, or sort of how the New Yorker frames this story, as Senate Democrats are looking into this. And so then the Times says that the Times had heard about it and had interviewed several dozen people over the past week in an attempt to corroborate this woman's story. I'm quoting here, and could find no one with firsthand knowledge. The woman who made the allegation herself contacted former Yale classmates asking if they recalled the incident, and told some of them that she could not be certain that Mr. Kavanaugh was the one who exposed himself. So this is, according to the New York Times, this woman told friends that she was not even certain that it was Mr. Kavanaugh, that it was Judge Kavanaugh. And also, there is no eyewitness in this story. And so the New York Times has, I don't want to say that the New York Times has called out the New Yorker explicitly here, but this is pretty close coming from a news side story. They basically said, we have been looking into this, and the only reason we are publishing what we have found, which is nothing, at this point, is that the New Yorker has already published.
Catherine, you're an editor. Is that journalistic malpractice? Is it, hey, look, you know what? There is discussion of a thing that's happening, and we're fleshing out the details of a discussion of a thing that is happening here. What's your assessment of the choices that the New Yorker made here?
My assessment is the unglamorous, this is a tough call, but the world's assessment is either this is the most egregious journalistic malpractice that has ever been practiced in the history of journalism, or this shows the New Yorker's commitment to the truth and is the most laudable thing this magazine has ever done, because that's where we are now. It's absolutely all or nothing. It's red team, blue team. People are so in it that I genuinely believe, like, it's not just that people are trying to play whatever each incremental development for their advantage. They genuinely believe that this was either the best thing or the worst thing the New Yorker has ever done. Because I am better than everyone and above the fray due to both my natural disposition and my libertarianism, I'm like, it's tough. It's a tough call.
This is not the process that we would have designed at all, beginning with Dianne Feinstein sitting on the original allegation for a long time. One might not have done what the New Yorker did. But Nick, is there an argument, kind of a preponderance argument here, that this ugly process, which has been ham-handed, adversarial, awful in many ways, and contributed to the ongoing delegitimacy of the Senate and the various institutions in American life, which you write so eloquently about often, is there an argument to be made that nonetheless, including Michael Avenatti, the Stormy Daniels lawyer, mm-hmm. coming in and saying, I got a third one over here.
Or perhaps more than a third, perhaps like, multiple. A busload. Yeah. I mean, he is
a party busload.
let's
is
not
this
go
ugly process.
Let's not investigate the metaphors here.
Coming out with was the idea that Kavanaugh and Mark Judge and a couple of other people were involved in basically like getting women fucked up and then having group sex with them.
Targeting them is this, and then getting them, yeah, getting yeah. them drunk or using other substances.
I mean, this is
substances.
Something straight out of their, you know, kind of Animal House or yeah.
And
National Lampoon stories. That
setting them up
in
and
the
presumably,
80s.
Although it doesn't quite say yeah. participating in, but setting them up for gang rapes. He yeah. uses the word, the email yeah. he published on his Twitter feed uses the word either gang rape or gang rapes.
Yeah. So there's
it's
that.
Easy.
Happy Monday, everyone.
So, Matt, in terms of the preponderance yeah. of the evidence, I think I know where you're going with it. And part of it is that, so we have all of these, you know, we have multiple stories and increasing numbers of them and tales that are, you know, really fucked up and are really disturbing. But each of them, like none of them is actually provable. And then, I mean, do we, for me, I've been trying to think about this in a non-political context because, like, in the end, I'm not, you know, I'm not desperate for Kavanaugh either to be on the Supreme Court or not based on his jurisprudence or any of that kind of stuff. And it's like, as a society, like, where do we go to get to a conversation that will actually address a number of things? And one of which is, you know, ongoing problems, you know, that we need to discuss about sexual assault. And, you know, and it's, you know, somebody like Harvey Weinstein, perhaps Harvey Weinstein's worst acts were 20 or 30 years ago, but, you know, it was current time. Kavanaugh stuff is all we're talking about, stuff from 30 or 40 years ago or 35 years ago. And we haven't necessarily come to terms with the massive, you know, wide and positive changes in social mores. And cultural mores, you know, from the mid-80s to now. And, you know, we need to be having a different conversation about, you know, I think the Me Too movement has been really helpful in bringing to light a lot of stuff, just like the, you know, Black Lives Matter brought to light an entire understanding that large parts of America were not conscious of. I think Me Too has done that. I also think that at times, and this example is the worst case scenario where it's so politicized and you just have people, as Catherine was suggesting, you know, they want one or the other binary thing to be true, absolutely, and we have no way of knowing, and all this is doing is kind of like keeping the fire going. It's burning more, it's putting more and more gas on the fire. It's not actually getting us to a place where we can figure out what goes next, because it's, you know, Matt, I'd be curious for you, obviously you were an editor of the magazine as well and have been an editor your entire professional life. Does the New Yorker, in the pursuit of its truth, I mean, like, they are really kind of circumventing certain kind of basic journalistic standards that are not perfect and there are reasons to avoid them. But, you know, it was only 2 weeks ago, was it only 2 weeks ago that the New York Times published its anonymous op-ed from within the Trump White House resistance, like in the name of fighting Trump, we're seeing a lot of people pull out the stops on a lot of stuff. And it's not like, okay, we're just going to do it this once. We're like,
I mean,
in the
maybe
middle
we're
going to
find out that the author of the op-ed was Rod Rosenstein.
Yeah.
And that's how this is all going to get tied together, since, of course, we can only understand these stories now in the context of serialized television.
I mean, one of the horrible things about sexual assault and the discussion and the reporting and also the criminal adjudication of all of these things, which are, should to be clear, they're all kind of separate ways of looking at this, is that it is among the most difficult of crimes, incidents to report on and suss out the truth of fairly. It just is that hard, even if it happened yesterday, let alone a long time ago, because it's, as we've covered in campus sexual assault cases, a lot of these things happen when people are in prime jackass age, prime drinking age, and a bunch of other things. So memories are a little difficult to get. It's oftentimes not there's not a lot of witnesses involved. So it's difficult at best. Even Ronan Farrow's best reporting on this, which one could argue was the first reporting of Harvey Weinstein, you know, one of his key witnesses there has turned out to be a bit of a problematic narrator, which is Asia Argento. I mean, she was one of the first one to come out about Harvey Weinstein. Now, my God, mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I'm ready to believe everything that comes out of Asia Argento's mouth at all. And like, that's a fascinating story on its own. So it's difficult in the best of circumstances.
Well, and, you know, just to kind of put it back to the cultural thing before we go on to the politics of the moment, in the specials that he released on Netflix at the end of the year, beginning of this year, Dave Chappelle talked about this stuff. In one of those, he talked openly about what was going on, and it was, you know, it was more raw then because it was only a couple months after the Harvey Weinstein stuff really started coming out. But he said after he had his nervous breakdown years ago after getting a big deal that he didn't feel comfortable with, he went to South Africa and he talked about the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions there. And, you know, he was saying, like, there needs to be something like that to talk about, like, sex, you know, sex dynamics or gender dynamics in the workplace or in culture. And that is, I think, that's where we need to be kind of going as a society or as a culture. And it's not like, oh, let's just pretend it didn't happen or everything's okay now. But it's a very different conversation than this one. And it is just like, I mean, who knows, by the end of this recording, we'll probably find out something even more disturbing and stunning, or it's, you know, I mean, you know, it's like from Pizzagate to this to whatever comes next. Like, if you can dream it, if you can say it, you can publish it, and it's gonna start, you know, shifting the conversation. And it's a little bit I find it a little bit discombobulating because it's not clear where any of this type of discourse goes to die. I think it just continues to persist.
Catherine, what's wrong with just withdrawing his nomination at this point? Would that be a bad thing for Republicans to get behind? Just say, hey, look, you know, this has just become all too incendiary. There are now multiple very thinly sourced stories that are accusing him, and we've got a bench we can go to. What would be wrong with that approach, if anything?
I mean, to be honest, at this point, I think that would be the most practical approach if your actual goal is to confirm a Supreme Court nominee. But I think that there are now many goals afoot in our political discourse, and that's only one of them. And despite the fact that people often pay lip service to how important the Supreme Court is, and this is, of course, my favorite but Gorsuch trope from people who are otherwise reluctant Trump backers, we are now just in a full-fledged culture war. This is not about a practical political outcome. It's about whether we, you know, hashtag believe all women, or whether it's hashtag not all men, or whether it's her too and us too and me too. And it's not... to resolve this by pulling Kavanaugh is not to resolve this at all. And I think if I were making these practical decisions, one thing that would be on my mind is, you know, a Supreme Court bench is only so deep. And, you know, if there's blood in the water, could the Republicans lose another Supreme Court pick? I mean, the natural choice.
Who they nominate, like, whoever comes next
could
get
tanked in a similar way. Like, I don't think it's ultimately the right approach, but I am sympathetic to people who see this as a kind of precedent setting, line in the sand. We have to die on this metaphor hill thing because this worked really well from the Democrats' perspective. It went well if Kavanaugh gets pulled.
Peter, I saw on Twitter someone describe this, I think, as the Spanish prisoners dilemma or something like that. Since you follow movies, can you explain to me what that means and whether it's true?
Well, The Spanish Prisoner is a great David Mamet movie that you should all watch.
You're just buying time, right, while you look up what the Spanish Prisoner dilemma is?
No, I'm not looking up what the Spanish prisoner's dilemma is at
He's
all.
He's looking up Ross Douthat. I can see his screen.
I am, in fact, pulling up Ross Douthat's Twitter feed because Ross basically made a pretty good argument on Twitter this morning that whatever happens, whatever Republicans do at this point, it is not ideal for Republicans. And so let's back up just a month or two when Judge Kavanaugh's hearing nomination and hearing looked a little less contentious. It was quite contentious from the beginning, to be clear, but it didn't look like it does today. what it looked like was that Democrats were very, very, very opposed to Kavanaugh and had basically no cards that they could play to stop his confirmation. And what they have done now is successfully leverage. If you want to, again, I should probably stop and say, looking at this purely in political terms, if that is the only way you are looking at this, then what this looks like is Democrats successfully leveraging the Me Too movement and things like that in order to, I mean, I think we would all agree that, you know, we're taping this on Monday morning. It is not impossible that Kavanaugh is withdrawn by the end of today, by the end of this podcast, by the end of this week. It's also quite possible, I think, that Kavanaugh gets confirmed. So if he gets withdrawn, then as Catherine said, Democrats will say this went well for us. If he gets confirmed, then I think, depending on how the hearing on Thursday with Ford, the first accuser, goes, depending on sort of how this plays out, it is quite possible and perhaps even inevitable that no matter what happens, the Supreme Court, the legitimacy of it will be somewhat tainted, not perhaps wildly, but at least a little bit. And that any time Kavanaugh rules on anything that comes even close to women's rights, those sorts of issues, but perhaps even other issues as well, there will be an argument about whether Kavanaugh is a legitimate justice and is somebody who should have been confirmed and sort of what his background is. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult to avoid that at this point. And so we are now in a position where Republicans can fold and can say, Democrats, you took you had nothing and you won. And again, I'm looking at this. I'm talking exclusively in political terms rather than about, you know, sort of the allegations, sort of the particulars of the allegations themselves. Or they can say, well, we're going to move forward with a situation where the Supreme Court's legitimacy is tainted. And to reinforce one more time that I'm looking at this in political terms, that is in part the problem, is that it is not possible to see this in the situation has unfolded in such a way that it is almost basically unavoidable that everyone ends up looking at this entirely through a partisan lens about whether they are going to win a partisan victory now in November in 2020, over the next 10 years of Supreme Court decisions, et cetera. And so we have partisan politics ruins everything. And it has, in this case, it is now sort of rolling through and ruining. And I mean, it's just, it's very ugly in a lot of ways.
Have you read anything about whether or not, what are the takes on how is this going to affect November turnout? Because, you know, in the end, we're partly in the era of Trump because Hillary didn't turn out as many voters as she needed.
The conventional wisdom as of this morning, which I'm not sure I agree with, but I should say that the conventional wisdom from Republicans at this morning is that the grassroots has been instantly turned on fire in favor of Kavanaugh, in part by the New Yorker story. But really sort of by the way Democrats have handled this. So you have the senator from Hawaii,
right,
who the Democratic senator from Hawaii basically saying, well, I'm looking at these allegations in the context of Kavanaugh's rulings. I'm basically saying, I'm not looking at these allegations as, you know, sort of we're going to attempt to assess the truth of them, but instead whether somebody who has ruled the way that Kavanaugh has, like he was an administrative law judge, if I understand correctly, like whether that shows that he...
But
it was probably
a
sexual
up?
Assaulter in high school. And so the argument is that if Republicans don't confirm Kavanaugh at this point, they will irritate the base. And if they do confirm Kavanaugh, the base will show up. Again, I'm
but
really
so will the Democratic
not,
base, right?
I'm
or
really
is
not
question?
Sure that I buy that at yeah. all. I do not feel like I have a good handle on the politics of this situation, which is, you know, it's Monday morning and it's rapidly changing.
Nick, Peter mentioned legitimacy or perceived legitimacy of the court. One of the Republican and conservative complaints that I'm seeing throughout this process is that the Democrats have kind of just shifted into a permanent, semi-permanent status of questioning the legitimacy anytime they lose, which I think is something that you might have touched on once or twice regarding the presidency. Looking at that in the Supreme Court last, is that a lens? Is that a fair assessment? Is that too much of a blanket generalization?
No, I mean, but it's you remember Trump before the election was even taken, you know, like before the polls opened, much less closed, he was already saying, like, I'm not going to, you know, if I lose, I'm not going to accept those results. And then, you know, it was weirdly after he won, he was still like investigating all the voter fraud that kept him from winning or so, you know, like it didn't make
kept
any
winning
sense.
The popular vote.
Yeah. But and Hillary now has, you know, said as much, you know, that this was an illegitimate election, et cetera. And that so, I mean, yeah, it's a really you know, Matt, and I'll say because we're older and we come from like what was then considered like a more cynical America because it was like the butt end of the baby boom. It was after, you know, it was all Altamont. Like we grew up, you know, Altamont was our Woodstock or something and it cast a long shadow. And you didn't believe anything that anybody in power said. You didn't believe in the legitimacy of the system. I feel like right now we're in a crisis of kind of legitimacy that was unimaginable. You know, even while watching Bad News Bears, which was all about how adult America had evacuated the field, you know, like that there were no grownups anymore and that anything ruled, you know, like we're so far beyond that. It's kind of unbelievable. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what happens, partly because the younger voices that are coming up are not, you know, I feel like they're not going to questions of truth or of pragmatics even. And so, you know, and I realize this is a hop, skip, and a jump, but when somebody like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was asked by Jake Tapper last week, how do you pay for that $40 trillion in extra new spending you want? And she wouldn't answer. It's kind of like we're not ushering in a new era of younger people who are actually taking policy seriously or pragmatic, you know, how do you, you know, what, how much can you raise in tax money? How much can you spend? How does that affect the economy? How, what are
do you
the
remember like 5 years ago when every news outlet was setting up like a policy vertical and it was like, let's hire four youngish people who are like smart to read a bunch of white papers and blog about them.
I mean, that was partly what Vox was supposed to be like. We're, you know, we're dealing with reality here. We're smart, you know, and now they're like totally fucking, they don't,
I was
well, they're covering the news because it's the news. But they, I will say, I will. I mean, I've written for Vox. Yeah. I know some of the folks over there. Full disclosure, et cetera, blah blah blah. The like Vox does, you know, invest in good policy coverage as well. And you can look at somebody like my friend Dara Lind, who is their immigration reporter, who's great and who has really added a lot of meaning, like substantive
that
value.
That is not
to
what's
the discussion.
Getting the clicks, right? I mean, and like I wouldn't. You know, Ezra Klein is
their top
extremely
story last
and increasingly
Friday.
Ideological.
Their top story last Friday was about how we got to see Batman's penis for the first time.
Speaking of Batman's penis, Catherine.
I'm just glad we're not talking about Toad from Mario Kart.
We are now.
Yeah.
God bless it. No, before we leave the subject entirely, I didn't want to let...
Batman and Toad from Mario Kart. That's where I'm actually comfortable discussing.
Yeah. Here. Not... want to leave President Trump out of the conversation. I think on Friday he broke what had been, you know, a pretty decent amount of not silence, so just, you know, he was acting okay for the first 4 or 5 days of this, and then on Friday he came out and tweeted, "I have no doubt that if the attack on Dr. Ford was as bad as she says, charges would have been immediately filed with local law enforcement authorities by either her or her loving parents. The radical left lawyers want the FBI to get involved now. Why didn't someone call the FBI 36 years ago?" Can you just explain succinctly, Catherine, to people who share that view, why it might not be the best way of looking at this?
Right. So, I mean, I think, you know, here on the Reason podcast, the very good first place to start is always to say, like, well, gee, why might people not have trusted the apparatus of the state to deliver justice? I think, you know, the particularly 30 or 35 years ago, the way that law enforcement handled cases of sexual misconduct was different and even less good than it is today. There's also, I think, there is an element there of, you know, sort of saying that the entire responsibility for dealing with rape or sexual misconduct rests on the immediate action of the alleged victim. That seems like a pretty bad moral economy to set up for lots of reasons. And I think, you know, most of all, this is and, you know, this is something that we've published on the site a bit, like this all fits in very neatly to the ongoing, very contentious debate about how to deal with due process for these claims on campuses. You know, this is similar to the Kavanaugh hearing, which is not about whether, you know, Kavanaugh is going to be imprisoned. It's not about whether he's going to lose his life or his liberty. It's just about whether he's not going to get a job. Similarly, on campuses, we are grappling with typically not whether someone will be imprisoned, but whether someone will lose their position at university or perhaps just their reputation. And that's a different set of considerations that some of these things do not always need to be dealt with in the context of the law. That said, what we've seen on campuses is that trying to deal with this in a gray area without well-defined rules of evidence and conduct and how we expose people's names and when and how we weigh different claims depending on how old they are, it's a mess. Of course it's a mess. Of course it's a disaster. And, you know, I think one thing that Trump's comments tap into is that people do desire the imperfect but still real clarity that the legal process brings to these type of claims. Unfortunately, that's just not available to us here. And to pretend like it was at some golden moment when she should have acted, I think, is to misunderstand the history of how we prosecute those claims.
You know, adding to that, though, too, it's like, okay, so Kavanaugh won't go to jail. I can't imagine if he doesn't get confirmed to the Supreme Court, he's going to get bounced from his current position or be forced out. But the charges against him are like, it's, you know, it's like, hey, don't worry about it because at least you're not going to jail. But it's like, you know, that he's a rapist, an attempted rapist. He's a blackout drunk. He is a horrible, horrible human being. Like, it's not a small, the charges against him, like, are not small, and it can't be advanced simultaneous that we don't have to hold, you know, we don't have to have real standards of evidence or process.
Right.
Because he's not going to jail.
No, that's true.
Because it's like, God, like this guy, like, you know, and I have no idea.
But it's true on campuses too,
yeah.
Right? Like
yeah.
The stakes are very, very high in
yeah.
both of these cases, but they are not, I mean, I think, you know, libertarians in particular would say being imprisoned or fined requires a different, like, not just a conversation that's different in scale, but a conversation that's different in
type. That's with the campus stuff too. I mean, it wasn't simply that, okay, you don't get like a court appointed lawyer or something. Half the time it seemed that people didn't even know the charges against them.
Right.
And then you're supposed to show up and maybe speak or not speak, and you can't, you know, I mean,
and Kavanaugh's in a very, I mean, at the beginning of this cascade of allegations, Kavanaugh was in a very similar position, I think, to those students that are accused, particularly when it's something that happened, you know, they're seniors and it's something that happened their freshman year, which, you know, for a kid, that's a significant amount of time to have elapsed. He's now in a situation that looks more like a legal case would look because so many details have come out, because so many people are invested in this investigation, because the names have basically all been revealed. It looks a little more like a criminal proceeding for this type of charge would look. And I think that tempts people to more directly analogize it to a legal proceeding when it still isn't.
I would just like to point out, as we transition here into the other topic that's exploding the interwebs today, that we've just spent 30 plus minutes talking about the latest, craziest developments in the Brett Kavanaugh case. And we didn't even talk about Ed Whalen even once. That's how crazy this past week has been. And we're not going to talk about it.
I do want to just meta talk about it, which is that I was at a conference on Friday and I got a text from Peter that just said, when you have a minute, we need to talk about the evil twin theory. And I was like, Jesus Christ. Can a girl not be offline for an hour and a half?
Nope is the answer to that question.
That's why we need the remnant.
The latest headlines to keep us all as fresh as possible.
We're going to talk about that later.
The news is I'll just read the headlines. Rosenstein departure appears imminent. Deputy Attorney General Roger Rosenstein is expecting to be fired. sorry, I'm going to violate my basic rule is to not cuss on this podcast, except if it's in quotes. And the third headline I see here is from Splinter, and the headline is "What the fuck is going on?" Sorry. We're all beginning to crack here, ladies and gentlemen. So the reporting has been that by the end of today, Rod Rosenstein's not going to be working as the deputy attorney general anymore, whether he quits or is fired by Donald Trump. And this is all stemming from yet another piece of strange reporting from the New York Times, which came out, I believe, on Friday, saying that there were evidence that Rosenstein had said stuff about maybe wiretapping the president or invoking the 25th Amendment as a way to get him out of there. This was then followed up by reporting by the Washington Post and elsewhere, which is more skeptical, saying, look, you don't understand. This dude has the worst sarcastic sense of humor you've ever seen. And this is him trying to be funny. And then there's a lot of will he, won't he be fired? And Rod Rosenstein, his importance in the national conversation and firmament of the judicial system is that he is overseeing the Mueller investigation. So he is the person who is doing this in lieu of Jeff Sessions, who's stepped aside from that normally, although Donald Trump hates him for doing that. So, Peter, I'm going to just start with you on this, since A, you live in Washington, D.C., and B, you are fond of saying that we don't have a constitutional crisis yet, except for how Congress doesn't do his job. Where are you on this as potential crisis threat level of Trump firing the person who's in charge of overseeing the investigation into Trump?
How do you pronounce Cthulhu?
Cthulhu,
I Cthulhu, think, yeah. Right? Like the Lovecraftian apocalypse monster
and perennial presidential candidate.
I don't know. I mean, I spent the entire evening of the 2016 presidential election just tweeting all of the all of the images of Cthulhu that I could find online. And I feel like I may need to do that again at some point this week. Look, we're like in the like reports of the apocalypse are nigh phase, but we don't think we're actually there yet. And, you know, one important question that has not been resolved is whether Rosenstein is being fired or whether he resigns. And this is important, not just for sort of the narrative about what's happening, but it's important because the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, if I understand correctly, and I should say that I am not a deep expert in these things, but if I understand this correctly,
you know, the name of it, so you are now.
That's right. In fact, I'm prepared to go on any television show and explain the history of the Federal Vacancies Reform Act within the hour. It gives Trump to appoint a new AG if he resigns, right? So if he leaves of his own volition.
Sessions or Rosenstein now you're talking about?
Rosenstein.
Yep.
And so if he leaves of his own volition, not an acting AG, whatever. Or whatever he is. That's right. And if I understand this correctly, again, I know I'm fairly certain this applies to Sessions. I'm somewhat less certain this applies to Rosenstein. But if I understand this correctly, that means that Trump is going to want to say he resigned. And perhaps if the reporting, the kind of very rumory type reporting that I'm seeing, if Rosenstein is not going to resign, if he's going to say, no, you've got to fire me, then that puts the sort of replacement effort in limbo. And of course, Rosenstein is involved in the Mueller probe and the Russia investigation in a way that Trump has not been pleased with. And so all of this kind of comes together in a big weird bureaucratic, political, paranoid Twitter shitstorm.
Cthulhu's campaign message, his slogan is always, why vote for the lesser evil? And, you know, I think there's something to be said. I think he's got my vote, you know, assuming that Gary Johnson makes it into the Senate in New Mexico and isn't running. But none of this will affect the Mueller investigation, right? I mean, that'll continue no matter what, unless it gets shut down. Then there'll be a super shitstorm. And it seems to me this is where, you know, to bring it back to like the larger Kavanaugh type stuff. And this is one of the things that Trump is fantastic at is delegitimizing all processes. Like he does it proactively on the, you know, I guess on the bet that he's going to lose or it's going to go against him. And then even when he wins it or it comes out his way, he still kind of like shits on it a little bit more. And what we're seeing now is that for a while it was only Trump doing that. But now the Democrats are kind of doing that with the, I think, with the Kavanaugh hearings. There's no way that they can be happy about anything, because even if Kavanaugh goes, Trump is still going to appoint somebody who they will vote completely against on the Supreme Court. And we're now, this is the dead end turn that we've made, where everybody everywhere always is trying to delegitimize the process before the decision is made, because everybody's expecting it to go against them, and then they want to be able to.
Yeah, so I don't, you know, Matt asked, what are we in a constitutional crisis? And I don't think we're quite there yet, though perhaps we're sort of edging, we're getting closer to one than we were yesterday or last year. But we are in a crisis of institutional legitimacy. And when I talk about institutions, the main thing that I want to sort of, what institutions are designed to do is to bring people to a consensus, right? And they are processes, and that's true with Kavanaugh. That's true with sexual assault cases on campus.
It's true with budgeting.
It's true with the budget process. It's true with all of these things. Is that we are witnessing a breakdown of consensus processes by which people who disagree wildly on things can come to an acceptance, if not an actual agreement, that this is what happens. And you see, I mean, so I will bring this back to a little hobby horse of mine, which is the Congressional Budget Office. And the Republican attacks on the Congressional Budget Office for years have basically been about breaking down the consensus that the Congressional Budget Office was built to provide. And that consensus is wrong in some cases and wildly imperfect in even more cases. On the other hand, the whole point of it is to provide a single number that is in the middle of the reasonable range, that basically everyone says, okay, maybe this is wrong, but we're all going to agree that this is about what about where it is, and that's how we're going to talk about it. And those, all of those kind of legitimizing processes and institutions are kind of under attack, and I think that has been accelerated in the Trump era by everyone, but in particular by the existence, presence, and style.
Okay, but I want to play the role of Nick Gillespie here for a minute and say, okay, but those institutions sucked, and that's what people like about Trump, right? Like there is a case to be made for delegitimizing bad institutions.
Okay,
I thought you were going to go in a different direction, but you're right. And then,
Nick is playing the role of Nick Gillespie. Go ahead.
I thought I was going to sound more optimistic.
The Congressional Budget Office. Yeah.
Right.
Again,
so what I was going to say is there's a distinction between the CBO and a Supreme Court confirmation hearing and the budget, like the payoff of delegitimizing these different institutions is very different, and the fact that Trump is indiscriminate about it is a problem. At the same time, you know, to say to people, this thing that you implicitly put your trust in is politically motivated, at least on some level, and that's being systematically undervalued by people who want to keep it intact for their own purposes, like, that's a good point.
Do you think it's impossible to, like, are we in a world that is so subjective that we can't get close to the truth? So why bother? And let's just do will to power to win whatever arguments we want. And both in the political arena, but elsewhere, because this is one of the things that
Nick's
like.
Nick's trying to get Nietzsche to help us resolve the sexual harassment the sexual assault claims.
Yeah, you don't go with Nietzsche on sexual harassment.
You always know you're not in a good place culturally.
No, but, you know, books by people like, I think Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now was one of the things that I responded to it to, and it was an attempt to go back to this old, like, kind of 19th century Enlightenment or liberal ideal of disinterested knowledge, where it's not just that you're not just advancing arguments because they will help you, but because they, you know, they may actually be a closer approximation of reality. And so, because I think a lot of what we're dealing with in these cases, and I think this is definitely true of Black Lives Matter and Me Too in a broad sense, is that there has been huge social progress since, say, like the mid-80s, just as a benchmark. But it's not perfect. But then a lot of the people involved in these movements want to act as if nothing has changed or things have gotten even worse. And then that creates a problem when you actually look at stuff. You know, and are we trying to clean up? Are we trying to clean the last bit of pollution in an ecosystem, or are we in such a fetid swamp that people are dying immediately? I mean, you see this in the environmental movement, you know, often talks about this way, that things are worse now than ever. And they're not. And like, we're having trouble kind of being realistic, I think, on like where we are, where we want to go, and how far we've come. And it fucks all of this stuff up, because Trump is still fucking talking. You know, to one of the great stories today that came out is that last year there was like no crime in America, essentially. Trump is not going to be like, yeah, he's not going to take credit for that. He's going to be, that's all lies. It's worse now than ever. People are being killed by illegal immigrants, and there are twice as many illegal immigrants in the country as we thought even 48 hours ago.
To me, the problem is not that people are saying that these institutions have issues and flaws. They do. And the issue is that they're trying to break them down and destroy them without really having any sense of what should replace them or caring one way or the other. And to me, the correct way to go about this is to say these institutions have flaws, either we should replace them with, and you need something that you can say after that, or we should improve them, and here's how. And improving flawed institutions seems to me to be a really good project that not nearly enough people are invested in, while breaking down institutions that, yes, are flawed often leaves us worse than we were with that flawed institution in place.
There's also a third option, which is the exit option, right? I mean, there's voice, there's burn it all to the ground, and then there's exit. And I do think, you know, this is these moments in our political discussion always tempt me to head out for the seastead. I don't know about you guys, but I do think legitimately, like, this is a framework that people do not adequately use to answer these conversations, to answer these problems. And so they conflate the voice option and the burn it all down option.
No, my actual takeaway from all of this news is that I'm really excited about playing Red Dead Redemption 2 for at least 1,000 hours.
So this is a form of exit.
Catherine,
yeah.
And you know, I agree with you. And I also then, like, how do you translate, or how do you map the exit option into something like Supreme Court rulings, or government, which in the end still, whether it's functional or dysfunctional, still has broad purview over our lives and things like that?
Can I answer that question by also preemptively doing my what am I consuming, Matt? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sugar.
So I spent the weekend, when I wasn't answering Peter's text about evil twins, at a conference on Albert J. Nock, who is probably most famous for his essay Isaiah's Job, or for his work in which he calls himself a superfluous man. And he's basically grappling with this question. He's basically saying, like, okay, the world around me, which in this case his world is the you know, the period of 20th century global war. The world around me is collapsing. Culture is degraded. Conversation, like, we read an essay about the decline of conversation. Conversation is impossible and low quality because people's materialist, consumerist, and small-mindedness ruins everything. And, you know, he goes full Candide, right? Like, he says, like, you just have to go cultivate your garden. Like, there's one person you can improve in this world, and it's yourself. And so I think, like, to ask that question, like, how do you grapple with this situation in the context of a fight over a Supreme Court appointment is probably just not, like, that's not the question, right? Like, the question has to be, you kind of fully withdraw, you know, maybe you sort of stipulate a kind of anarchism like he did. And then you say, but to be honest, I'm going to, like, have drinks with H.L. Mencken and wait for it to be over. And he does this thought experiment where he says, if I could push a button and institute the political framework that I want to see, would I do it? And he says no, because the culture around those institutions is so degraded that they would immediately be replaced by something probably not identical, but actually worse. And so I think, you know, in this case, that's basically what Peter is saying, right? Like, you can't burn it down, because unless you have, like, unless you have the thing that comes
those
after
North Korean nukes.
And he has this whole rhetoric about making men fitted for freedom. And I don't know that that works overall, and it's certainly condescending and paternalistic. On the other hand, I think you could argue that, for instance, the legalization of gay marriage and marijuana were a story of men becoming fitted for freedom, right? Of people sort of getting their heads around a way to be more free without being self-destructive.
One terse little Twitter exchange this morning that I was looking at perhaps sheds some kind of light on this, and also kind of danger as part of the conversation that we're having about institutions. Glenn Thrush from the New York Times tweets out, "Good morning. Can anybody name a single institution or endeavor that spans political and cultural divides that unites the country around something positive?" And Dan Dresner, the political science guy, says, "Yeah, the military, which is in and of itself a problem." And I think about that in terms of, there's a mindset within libertarianism that's like, yeah, let's burn the mother down. There were some, you know, there was a handful of libertarians, or more than a handful, who enjoyed the rise of Donald Trump as a way to kind of smash things. And I understand that point of view on one level, and on another, I recoil from it. And that mindset also overlaps pretty strong with the most kind of anti-war voices that you will hear within libertarianism and elsewhere. And that's the thing. When everything is smashed, who are people going to love? Or, you know, if we go back to that, we're talking about like countries that have where the it's only the military that has legitimacy, you know, like Turkey and South America, kind of Caudillo states. That's not a healthy place to be, and it's not a peaceful place to be when everyone is just looking at the military as the last place that can kind of absorb us all. And people interested in that topic, Rosa Brooks, who served in the Obama administration, had a good book whose name I'm blanking on, 3 or 4 years ago, talking about how what happens when we only think that the military is the only place that has legitimacy, and so therefore we start with a kind of a military first point of view in our policy, and that comes with all kinds of bad problems and pathologies. And with that, I'm going to let Nick and I join the What Are You Consuming? Although, Peter, I think you can expand on your thoughts. But I'm going to go first because I finally read a book that I know Nick read a long time ago, and I presume Catherine, and who the hell knows about Peter. But it's just tickled me to no end, a total delight. The 1972 kind of memoir track, crazy fun thing by Jerome Tuchilli. It usually begins with Ayn Rand. So much fun. Everyone, if you're interested in like the history of the libertarian movement and just really funny writing, every single paragraph has a sentence that's going to make you grin. A lot of references to things that happened then that completely happen now, including Catherine was talking about seasteading. That's they're talking about it back then. Pointless schisms between libertarian tribes. Everyone comes out looking ridiculous, but yet it's sort of sympathetically ridiculous, including the author himself. A pure pleasure that gives us kind of like a, where the Northeastern part, which is a very important beating part of the like creation of the libertarian movement in the late 60s and early 70s. Great, super fun. Nick, tell
and
me
then,
how right I
oh,
am.
Oh, no. And I love the one chapter ends with a line something like, "And then I met the Gallimbosian."
Yes.
And then it goes into this interaction he had with this follower of a guy who would only tell you his ideas after you paid him a lot of money and sworn that you would not share these ideas with anybody because they were his intellectual property. It usually begins with Ayn Rand. It's a phenomenal book, semi-novel. Catherine had mentioned Candide. It's like Candide. It reminds me Nathaniel West, the writer who did Day of the Locust and Miss Lonely Hearts, had a book that's a little less well known and should be better known called Cool Million, where it's just, it's a beautiful allegory. It's almost like it's, the one thing before I get onto what I was consuming over the weekend, Matt, is just that it's also, if you liked It Usually Begins with Ayn Rand, run through Jerry Tuccilli's oeuvre, and he also wrote the first big biography of Donald Trump in the 80s. He is one of the most insightful, fascinating writers and researchers and whatnot. He did a great, I had the opportunity to interview him a few times. We obviously all worked with his son. But he wrote a great history of the Gallo wine family called Gallo Be Thy Name, which is phenomenal. He wrote a book about the black soldiers who actually won the Spanish-American War and got fucked over by Teddy Roosevelt called Buffalo Soldiers. Really just, he has a shelf full of books that are all worth reading in my experience.
And in the current print issue, we have an essay by his son, J.D. Tuccilli, on his death, which is quite touching. Oh. And I believe the headline is Embrace the Dirt Nap.
Yeah. Wow. Matt, on Friday, I went to see the acclaimed play musical based on Bob Dylan's work from England called Girl from the North Country. And it's kind of like, you know, Mamma Mia or Jersey Boys, but done with Dylan stuff. The play itself is terrible. It's really an uninteresting set of kind of sinew to just pull together a bunch of songs. What's fascinating, especially if you like Bob Dylan, is that it's mostly lesser known songs. A couple of the big hits like a Rolling Stone are in there, but it's really for fans, and it works extremely well. And it was a profoundly moving experience for me, mostly because, and this goes to the question of what can unite us, it made me think of at least a dozen people who I was friends with, who liked Dylan like I do, like we had some Dylan connection. And it was just this wonderful evening of memories that had nothing really to do with what was going on the stage. It was like you hear these songs and you think of people you hadn't thought of. And you feel a little bit good and a little bit sad. I mean, it's like
Bob Dylan is an institution. He brings
really
people
is.
Together.
He totally is. And his, in the late turn of his work has been to kind of cover more ground and kind of bring his existing listeners. He brings them new material, you know, et cetera. He's really quite a huge, powerful force for good.
He is a communal process for the generation of norms.
Yeah. I agree. Thank you.
Peter, I can't believe that we let you get away with that. Do you want to amplify your remarks, Peter, about what you've been consuming?
So Red Dead Redemption 2 doesn't come out until the end of October, but I spent the weekend watching The Deuce, which is the HBO series co-created by David Simon, who co-created The Wire, who was a creator of The Wire and Treme and some other shows, and George Pelicanos. This show is about the sex trade, prostitution, the sort of development of the porn industry in New York in the early 1970s. The first season, it takes place entirely in 1971. The new season moves forward to the late 1970s. I haven't watched the two most recent episodes, but I've watched the full first season and then the beginning of season two. And it's a really sharply shot, written, and acted show. And it's really smart about the ways in which markets thrive, even in places where there are heavy attempts to squelch them, and even in places where there's a lot of kind of social resistance to those markets existing, and the ways in which the kind of making markets black markets has deleterious consequences for the people who are involved in them. And so in a lot of ways, it resembles some of the best parts of The Wire, I think, which The Wire a lot of what it did very well was show how these sort of various organs of the city and of kind of human nature and of kind of the desire for people by everyone to make a living for themselves and to to participate in commerce, even when that commerce is outlawed, and the ways that commerce sort of comes up through the cracks. And The Wire was often a sort of thought experiment in, well, what would happen if we reduced, say, some of the social strictures around these things or social dogmas, or what would happen if we took the government out of this, right? Sort of there's the famous plot in, I believe, season 3 of The Wire about Hamsterdam, and there's something that somewhat echoes that in the first season of The Deuce. I will say it's very, very bleak. There's an awful lot of violence towards women. It's handled, I think, really quite smartly and pretty gently, pretty delicately, all things considered. But this isn't like a great happy show for people who wanna feel good about the world and their lives. On the other hand, it's a really smart show, and it's really well written, acted, and just sort of gorgeously shot. Pretty much at every frame, it's really just a kind of on a craft level. It is a real pleasure to watch.
As long as we can all agree that the newspaper season of The Wire is garbage and that David Simon is one of the biggest fart knuckles on Twitter. And I think I learned that word from him. He's got a really wonderful dialogue, but just, wow, what a dick on Twitter.
The newspaper aspect of the newspaper season of The Wire was a mess. There was some great stuff even still in that season, and that's often how I feel about David Simon, is that even in some of his shows, even in some of his works that I really kind of don't like, there's still something, right? There's like a commitment to quality, and there's a seriousness there. He's an incredibly frustrating human being individually, as Reason's interactions with him have shown. As far as I can tell, 100% of online interactions with him, like, you never see the guy, like, sort of acting just kind of generously and like, you know, sort of, he's like, he just seems like a really curmudgeon and grump. I should also sort of add, this, unlike The Wire, which was really a David Simon product, this show is more driven, it seems to be, by George Pelicanos, who was also a writer on The Wire and wrote the penultimate episode, which is always the one where shit gets real in every season of The Wire. It's really well made. And I think that this is not a libertarian show. This is not a show made by libertarians. It is one, however, that kind of, even if only grudgingly, works from some libertarian insights about the inevitability of commerce and also about the dignity of sex work and the people who choose, or in some cases don't choose, to be in it.
Yeah, I think part of his tormented relationship with Reason and libertarians more broadly was that for a long time, The Wire was, you know, it was a widely regarded show, but it wasn't necessarily that popular. And libertarians loved it because it really revealed or dramatized a lot of dynamics. And then he got kind of pissed off by because he's not a libertarian. He calls himself a socialist and he means it. So when we interviewed him a few years ago over Treme, which I think is one of his minor works at best, he was like, okay, I'll talk, but we can't talk about politics. And then all he wanted to, he was just like libertarian baiting me from the minute we showed up. And I can understand that.
I think in some ways the show is presented, I would bet that the creators of the show view it in many ways as a critique of capitalism and of kind of the ways that capitalism ends up working with the state and sort of in order to advance its cruelties. And you know what? When markets sort of end up when the public-private partnership is like a thing that libertarians complain about a lot, because it is in fact an opportunity for graft and exploitation, and David Simon's work shows that really consistently. Better than basically anybody else who I can think of, certainly making television, but even any other sort of fiction creator the last couple of decades.
That's all the fiction creation we have time for this week. Thank you all for listening. Buckle in for a long week of Fridays, which we seem to be having here. And please subscribe to us there on the iTunes machine. Write reviews of us. Make jokes, mostly at Nick's expense, but occasionally at Peter's as well. And we'll catch you here next Monday. Thanks.